I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
3 employees and 2 work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Hey there, strangers. Today we're doing something we've never done before. We are doing an Ask Me Anything. I put out the call for questions about a month ago, and you all did not disappoint. And so, without further ado, let's go. So let's start with this question from Gretchen. She asks, what made you get into strange and unexplained? Have you had an obsession with strange and unworldly things your whole life? Did you grow up in a haunted house? Well, Gretchen, I had a friend who had started a podcasting network, and during COVID, toward the very beginning, actually, he reached out and asked if I'd be interested in making a podcast. And he actually pitched the idea to me. I was lucky enough a couple years ago to take the show over myself, which has been an interesting experience. But yeah, I grew up watching things like Unsolved Mysteries, The Twilight Zone, Tales from the Dark Side, Tales from the Crypt. You remember that guy?
Guess you heard the old saying, if looks could kill, so she did.
I did not grow up in a haunted house, as far as I know, although I've never really had an experience with a ghost or whatever. So sometimes I think that it's just me. Maybe I'm just closed off to it. The house I grew up in Brooklyn was quite old, actually, and sort of falling apart, but it wasn't haunted as far as I know. It was scary. We didn't have many lights because, I don't know, we just didn't have money. And so I would have to run upstairs as fast as I could to get to my bedroom where I could turn the light on, because I was scared that monsters were coming after me. But I never really had like an experience with anything like that. And then on a related note, a listener named Crystal asked, what was one of, if not the story/article that you remember from your youth that started your path down the dark and mysterious? Mine was reading about Betty and Barney Hill. I became obsessed with UFOs. I also blame my mom for having a pretty comprehensive collection of V.C. Andrews novels just laying around. I read all of them compulsively at an age I would consider far too young. You know, I'm not a macabre person. I'm not the kind of person who has, like, taxidermied animals in my house or pentagrams or I don't know what people do. And I've always been very skeptical, although I will say that doing this show has sort of changed my mind on a lot of things, because I really do think that there are things about the human experience that are unexplainable, you know? I've become, I think, a little less hardened since doing this show. I remember reading some true crime books when I was young, but the one that really stuck out was the murder of Shanda Scherer in 1992. She was tortured and murdered by some girls who, you know, were her friends in some weird jealous rage involving another girl and crushes and all kinds of stuff. And it was terrifying to me. And I think in part it was terrifying because I had that experience that a lot of us have in junior high or high school, where my group of friends just suddenly sort of turned on me. I think I just sort of wasn't cool enough for them. They all liked to smoke pot, and I tried and tried and tried to smoke pot with them, and it just made me insane and miserable. And so I wasn't worried that my friends were going to turn around and murder me, but I think there was something to that feeling of like friends turning on you, right? And this was like sort of the worst possible scenario of that happening. And then I had the opportunity to audition for a musical based on that story. And I got it. And I ended up turning it down because I had actually just had a nervous breakdown. I just turned 18, and there were circumstances that led to me sort of completely collapsing. I had panic attacks, and then I had some agoraphobia. And then finally, my parents were like, you need help. And so I spent like 10 days in a hospital. And this was my first audition out. And it occurred to me that being in a musical about kids who murdered one of their friends was probably not where I needed my brain to be at that time. And I was really worried that I wouldn't be able to handle it psychologically. It's interesting because I've said this a few times on the show now, but like after more than four seasons of doing this show, I am never not shocked at the sheer depravity of people. I guess I just have more faith in people than maybe they deserve. So I guess I continue to be drawn to these stories because I just am confounded by what people will do to each other and why, you know? All right. This question is actually also from Gretchen. How do you stay motivated to keep pushing out podcast episodes when your life just takes over? So you might hear my son yelling and screaming in the background. They're on VR. But today is an example of me pushing through. It's a Saturday and doing work because it needs to get done. My therapist recently told me that I have a strong inner drive. And I was like, no, I don't think it's inner. I think it's a terror of losing everything and not being able to feed my family. So I keep going because I sort of have no choice. I have to. Which is why sometimes I hope that my listeners have a little bit of grace for me. I recognize that some weeks might be stronger than other weeks, but I do think that every episode is interesting in its own right, and I hope that every episode is interesting enough to keep people around. But I also know that sometimes it might not be, which is also hard and terrifying in and of itself. Also, those of you who follow me on social media know that I've been struggling with some chronic exhaustion that nobody seems to be able to figure out. I don't have Lyme disease. I don't have mono. I don't have a vitamin D deficiency. I'm just tired. And it does make it hard. And what I tend to do is I work for very intense hours. You know, I'll work like 4 or 5 really intense hours a day, and that's what I can do. And then I'm sort of depleted. But, you know, the show must go on. And I love connecting with listeners. I love the thought that, like, somebody might be having a bad day and their feed pops up with a new strange, and they're like, oh, great. This will be a half an hour of my day that I can maybe take your mind off of the horrors. So that's what keeps me going. The sheer terror of not being able to keep a roof over my family's head and wanting to bring some sort of needed distraction in a world that is very, very scary. A listener with the screen name Kendav asked, do you have a favorite episode that you have made? The episode that always pops into my mind is the simulation theory episode. I think that one sort of blew my brain apart in a lot of ways. And that was sort of, I think, maybe a turning point for me where I was like, I don't understand things. And there are things out there that are unknowable and ununderstandable. And that's scary, but it's also just is what it is, you know? That said, I'm so proud of the Typhoid Mary episode. It's just goofy and it makes me laugh. I like episodes where I can lean into my humor and just sort of have fun. Sometimes the topic is light enough that, like, it lends itself to just sort of having fun and making jokes. And sometimes I'll try to do that after a string of, like, super depressing or dark episodes. I also want to say, too, that, like, these topics take a toll on me as well, you know? Especially writing about things that have happened to children. I don't remember who it was I was writing about, but there was a woman who disappeared. And inevitably, they found out it was either her boyfriend or some guy who, you know, felt jilted by her. And I screamed into a pillow in the episode. And that was also a point for me where I was like, I almost wanted to stop doing disappearances, especially of women, because I felt like the outcome was always the same. And I was so frustrated and upset by it. It's frustrating and upsetting to look at something that keeps happening and it just keeps happening, you know? And it's like you're looking at the chalkboard and it says 2 + 2 = 4, but everybody else is looking at it and saying, no, 2 + 2 = 5. And you're just like, why are we not addressing this? I'm not really an activist. I can't. I'm tired. And I wouldn't know where to start. And I'm not good with confrontation. Like, I'm not able to walk into a police department and be like, give me a file, see? I'm too much of a roly-poly bug for that kind of thing. Maybe I hope that, like, somebody will hear these things and want to take some action. Maybe just sort of shining a light on these things will spark some action from my listeners. That said, it's hard to say what my favorite episode is because there have been so many, and also I forget. Like, I'd have to go back through and sort of look at every single episode, and I'm sure there are lots in there that I'd be like, wow, I don't remember this. Oh, also the Mandela effect was really super fun as well. I especially liked it when people sent me angry DMs about it. Like, why are you so upset? It's okay. We're all going to be okay. I mean, we might not, but like, when it comes to an episode in which we're just talking about people remembering things differently, we're going to be okay. Let's all just have a popsicle and take a nap. You know what I mean? A listener named Katie asks, how are you doing? How are you holding up during this dumpster fire? I'm finding it increasingly difficult to smile these days. So how do you do it? What makes you smile? Oh, goodness, Katie. I'm okay. You know? I have a roof over my head. I have a beautiful home, and I'm very lucky that I really, really like my family a lot. And we can eat food, we cook, and my son is able to go to a good school. You know, we have our relative health, but this is a very scary time. I know that one of the biggest complaints about my podcast is that I'm too political and like I'm always talking about politics, but here's the thing. That is who I am. That's who I am. So actually, the funniest bad reviews I get are like, the topics are good and the stories are good, but the host ruins it. I write the show. So if the story is good, it's because I'm writing it. I wrote it. It's my viewpoint. And I am a deeply political person. I am someone who sees politics in everything. I turn on my tap and fluoridated water comes out and I recognize the politics behind that, that I have clean water that I can drink, that there's a natural occurring chemical in there that helps strengthen teeth, that before they put it in the water, people's teeth fell out. I live on land that I recognize was stolen from other people. Like, I live with a lot of liberal guilt about all of these things that affect the world that I can't do much about. I fucking recycle, even though it's probably pointless at this point. I compost. I have a garden. There's only so many green beans I can eat, though. You know what I mean? I am a deeply political person, and it infiltrates every single aspect of my life. And so I cannot put out content that doesn't include politics. It's impossible. So I don't know how I'm holding up. These are very, very scary times. Like, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. These are scary times. You know, a year ago, I put out an episode just sort of looking at the similarities between what Trump is doing and what Hitler did. I never said Trump was Hitler. I never said he was a Nazi. But I did point out the similarities in their strategies and their politics and the things they both did to get into power. And now here we are a year later, and there are masked people pulling citizens off the street and putting them into unmarked vehicles and disappearing them. There's a concentration camp in Florida, as well as in other places. People are dying because of policies that are being made. And politicians are being silenced. People in the media are being silenced. And when I say silenced, I mean arrested, having their shows pulled, being sued for millions of dollars. These are real things that are happening. It's hard to understate how scary the world is right now. And because I see politics and everything, it's tough. It's tough. And I've had to shut myself off from a lot of the news because I can sometimes barely function. I know that it's very bad. And I also know that it's even worse than what I know because I'm not paying attention to a lot of it because I can't for my mental health. So I take naps. I take a lot of medication to get through the day. I take anti-anxiety pills and antidepressants. I've been doing that since I was about 18. I take a lot of pills. I meditate sometimes when I remember. I try to get out into the sunshine. Again, I'm very privileged. I have a little back deck that I can sit on. We built a fountain. So sometimes I'll sit out there and put the fountain on and I'll just write or read or do something. So that's one way I get through. I'm reading as much as I can. I'm sort of getting my attention span back for that. I am rewatching The Good Place for the fifth time. Let me tell you, that show is as close to perfect as a show can get. I truly believe that. It is almost flawless. And if you haven't watched it, you should. Unfortunately, it's about to go to Prime, which is ironic because it's about trying not to do harm to people. Jeff Bezos.
CEO entrepreneur, born in 1964, Jeffrey Bezos.
In terms of smiling, you know, I think it's important to find things that make you laugh, which again is why I try to infuse my humor into my shows. I mean, I can't help it. Again, it's just who I am. So whatever, but like find the things that make you laugh, find the things that make you feel better because that's important. It is important to fill your cup with things that are nourishing in order to get through. Sometimes I acknowledge it can also be really hard to allow yourself to feel good or feel pleasure because so many people are suffering. But if you can't function, then what are you going to do for the world anyway? You know? So we have to find ways to laugh, even if it's just watching videos of people falling or like dogs being silly or people scaring each other. Those always make me laugh. Otters holding hands, The Good Place. I'm also rewatching Parks and Rec. I was watching SVU. I got to about season 17 and I had to take a break because, again, it was just one awful thing after another. And I decided to just take a break into comedy. And so that's what I've been doing. But it is important to laugh and to feel good and to feel nourished. Otherwise, it's sort of impossible to keep going. And I appreciate you asking me how I'm doing. It's tough. It's tough. All right, let's see. This question is from a listener named Molly. Oh, well, she asks which episodes have affected the way I think about the world. That would have to be the simulation theory episode. Although, again, like I just re-listened to the Ouija board episode because I put it out again. And I was surprised at how derisive I was at the whole town of Salem that I was like, ah, Stevie Nicks wannabes and patchouli and rah, rah, rah. I love Salem now. Like, I actually think it's kind of great. And since then, I really have sort of gotten into tarot and crystals and some light witchcraft. And I also did an episode on near-death experiences or something. And the subject of the episode reached out to me and only took issue with the fact that I called him out for not calling his daughter when he thought he was dying. And he told me personally, I just didn't want to put it on her plate. Like she had too much to deal with. And also it would have made it more real. And he ended up surviving. That affected me too, because I was like, oh, right, these are actual people that I'm talking about, you know? And in my defense, that was in season one, I think. So yeah, that was a reminder that these are real people. And I do tend to have pretty like strong and salty opinions. And so, you know, I think I've become a little less salty in my old age. But the multiverse stuff and the simulation theory stuff, that stuff really turned my mind inside out and really made me feel like I didn't know anything. Molly asks, what is your dream vacation? literally any vacation at this point, because I have not had one in ever. And when I say in ever, I mean many, many years. I mean, dream, if we're just being like silly gooses, I want to start in the northern tip of Italy, or I guess I'd have to start in Sardinia, because I found out I'm 1% Sardinian, and just like eat my way through Italy. So like maybe take 6 months or a year, just eat my way through Italy. That's what I would like to do. But I would also, at this point, really love to just sit on a beach and not think about anything. A friend of mine was like, why don't you go on a writing retreat? And I was like, because then I'd be writing, which I love. And I'd love to do some writing for myself. I don't really have much time for that. But like, I write for a living. I would like to do something where I don't have to do anything. I would like to lay on a beach. I would like to have somebody bring me shrimp cocktail, endless shrimp cocktails, and drink pina coladas. Please don't DM me about how eating shrimp is bad for the environment. Listen, I love you all. I really do. Like, I wouldn't do this if I didn't love you guys. But some of you message me about the wackiest stuff. I had a sponsor. I had Smalls Cat Food as a sponsor. And I did a commercial where I said there's a stray cat in the neighborhood. And sometimes I fantasize that it will have kittens under my porch so I can adopt a kitten and feed it Smalls. I got multiple DMs about that, that it was irresponsible to let stray cats have kittens. What? I know that. I know that we're supposed to neuter them, but it was a fantasy. Do you see what I'm saying? I get the weirdest DMs. Somebody DM'd me about dog food because it contained meat and you shouldn't eat meat. Like, everybody, please take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. And if I sound defensive, it's actually because I am. I get 99 wonderful messages from people telling me how much they love the show, how it gets them through their day, how I make them laugh, how I make them think about things in different ways, how maybe sometimes they disagree with me, but they still really love the way I present things, which is so awesome. And then I'll get one where someone's like, you're illiterate. Somebody told me I was illiterate. And that's what's going to stick because I'm a human being. Yeah. So I would just, please don't DM me that shrimp are bad for the environment. I know. Also, please just let me have this fantasy and know that it's okay. You don't have to DM me. I know that eating shrimp is bad. I know that everything is bad for the environment. But I'm also just trying to get from point A to point B. And I'd like to sit on a goddamn beach where I don't have to think about anything for a week. What is my favorite genre of music to listen to? I don't know that I have a favorite genre, but I will say that I think music stopped being good in the mid-90s. And I've said that for years. And then I found out that there was actually something that happened politically in the mid-90s. It had something to do with Clinton signing like an FCC thing. And it basically turned radio into just like a chart machine, I guess. I don't really know the ins and outs of it. There was a great article about it in Rolling Stone. But basically, they marked the exact year, and it was like the year that I had said, like somewhere between 94 and 97, that music stopped being good because it became like a focus group thing. And when I say that, also, I'm being hyperbolic. My kid loves BTS. I think I like BTS. They're great. Sometimes I like Harry Styles. I don't really know any of the contemporary people because I don't listen to it. But the other day, I randomly wanted to hear a Rod Stewart song, so I put that on. Radiohead is one of my favorite bands. Obviously, Beastie Boys. Huey Lewis and the News. Their album, Sports, terrific album. You should listen to it. Oh, and I love Ella Fitzgerald. I think maybe she was one of the best musicians of all time. Chris Cornell, one of the best rock and roll singers of all time. Otis Redding, I think, is incredible and should be rediscovered. Let me light the camera called Mama. I'm so hot to hell and I, yes, I am. Oh, my buddy Kelly, who I interact with on social media sometimes, asks, what are the books, movies, games that never get old and always make you feel better when you get down? Well, The Good Place. Lost, although I haven't revisited that in many years. Parks and Rec, although I hate the way they treat Jerry. Casino Royale, the one from 2006, not the one from the 60s. 28 Days Later, I love that movie. Fried Green Tomatoes, probably one of the best movies ever made. I really like humorous essays. Samantha Irby, Jenny Lawson, Jenny Slate, Phoebe Robinson. Her books are great. I like stories that I can sort of dip in and dip out of. I also really like short science fiction stories and speculative fiction. Games. I really enjoy Days Gone. There was a great game that I played on the Xbox when I had the Xbox that's so random, but it was stacking dolls, you know, those Russian stacking dolls. And you were on this like steamship. You were the Russian stacking dolls and you had to like make collections of each other and solve these puzzles. So random, but it was so good and I can't find it. Also, another old game that I used to play was called Black and White, where you were a god and you could either be benevolent or malevolent. Dungeon Keeper, that was super fun. I loved that one. And a new game that I really like is called Blue Prince. Blue and then Prince, like not a king, but a prince. I got super into Myst when I was a teenager. I've tried to play it more recently, but it's a little too old at this point.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
My friend Janine wrote in with quite a few questions. Thank you, Janine. I'm curious to hear anecdotes about the different shows you've worked on as an adult. Gosh, let's see. Well, I have some Christopher Walken stories. I was in James Joyce's The Dead with him off-Broadway and then on-Broadway in like 2000, I think. But I just told them on an episode of What Went Wrong, which will be coming out in early October sometime. The episode's about the movie Brainstorm, so you can check that out when it comes out. But it's also just a great podcast, What Went Wrong. It's about what went wrong on like famous movies. It's really well researched and the hosts are so knowledgeable. So I recommend it. And I'm going to have them on as guests to Strange as well. Honestly, some of my favorite theater experiences were with shows I did in California, which is ironic because everyone's always like, there's no theater in California. I did a world premiere of a Christopher Shin play called On the Mountain, which was essentially about a mother and daughter whose former partner and father, respectively, was like a Kurt Cobain type character. So he was dead and he was this big iconic rock star. I think I was like 24 and I was playing 16. It was directed by Mark Rucker, who unfortunately died some years later, very young and way too soon. And he was one of my most favorite directors I ever worked with. I really loved him. Oh, God, he was so great. I don't even really have an anecdote about that show. I just really loved it. I was in Lacusa's Wild Party in Los Angeles, and I played Sally, a character who spends almost the entire show in sort of like a drugged out stupor. And she comes to during an orgy to sing a song, which I did topless, by the way, completely topless. And she has like one line at the end of the play. She just goes, "Who's Sally?" And our director for that one gave us enormous freedom. We were all on stage the entire time. And he just sort of went like, go, just have a party. And then we would have to work out where to be for our moments, right? Like our songs or our dialogue or whatever. And since I was supposed to be on a lot of drugs, I got to sort of play around with various stages of being high at a party. And one review I got said that it was the most convincing portrayal of an inebriate they have ever seen. And in retrospect, I'm not sure that's something to be proud of. I did another world premiere of a play up at La Jolla Playhouse. I was 21, I think. No, I must have been 23 because I was already engaged to my first husband. And I was playing 11. And I really loved that experience. The playwright, Annie Wiseman, became a good friend. And she went on to write for TV. And the director, Lisa Peterson, was just terrific. I really loved working with her. You know, if I'm being completely honest, which I can't help but be anyway, I have worked with a lot of really bad directors, like egomaniacs, unqualified, in over their heads. And I don't have a good poker face. So once I start to lose respect for a person, it's really hard for me to mask it. It's something that I need to work on. And that's inevitably caused a lot of tension. I've ended up not speaking to more than one director by opening night. And look, I'm not blameless, I'm sure. I can probably be difficult. Also, to be fair, I was in my 20s for a lot of these, which is basically a fetus. I think I was a little too big for my britches. Honestly, I thought my shit didn't stink, so I may have been a bit of a pain in the ass. But if you know what you're doing as a director, we're going to be golden. I worked with one director who simply just did not understand the play. Like, he had completely misinterpreted it. Oh, God, I hated him. I hated him. I ran into a castmate from that play last Christmas, and he was like, "You called it, man. You called it before any of us did." And I was like, "Yeah, I feel bad because just like I hated him so much." And my buddy was like, "Yeah, no, but you were right. Like, he was awful." He ended up getting fired as artistic director right after that show. He'd been there for a long time. So I wasn't wrong. I had one director tell me he needed more access to me, and I had no idea what that meant. And his direction was like, in general, was overly complicated. I don't know, like too esoteric or theoretical or something. Like, if you need me to talk faster, just tell me to talk faster. You know, you don't have to give me like a weird lecture about motivation and intent or whatever. Just say, can you pick up your cues, or this character needs more frenetic energy or whatever. It's not hard. And I watched all the other actors in the show struggle with him as well. Just, you know, he'd give these weird, hard to decipher directions, and the actors would be like, "What? What? Like, I don't understand." Anyway, so he told me he was going to need more access to me. And the next day, I asked him what he meant by that. And he literally went, "Oh, did you go into a shame spiral?" "Yeah, bro, I kind of did." Like, how is that going to help me open up more? Woof. I had a lot of fun doing guest spots on TV shows. I was pretty good at making like the regulars on the show laugh between takes. You know, with shows like The Mentalist or Without a Trace, where the actors basically do the same thing every week with a parade of guest actors just coming and going, it's fun to come in there and sort of break them out of their routine and make them laugh. I had one scene on The Mentalist, and about a half hour into shooting, Simon Baker said, "You're really good. Why didn't we save you for a bigger part?" And I was like, "Dude, you're the producer. Why are you asking me?" And I had Poppy Montgomery, whom I was told was notoriously difficult and icy, laughing so hard in between takes that she ended up laughing on camera and ruining takes. So that was really fun. She was in a really bad mood when she showed up on set. And like within 15 minutes or so, we were joking and having a great time. I do like working on TV. It can be a slog. You know, it's a lot of sitting around and waiting. I was a recurring on a show where the regular cast was all very young. They were all in their like early to mid 20s. And I was almost 40. I had been acting longer than they had been alive, literally. And, you know, I think they all sort of thought, they were like what I had been like in my 20s. They were like, "Well, I'm a star now," you know, sort of just a little bigger in their minds, you know, than what reality was. That was tough to watch because I'd been around for so long, you know, and I was just a supporting player in the show. And so it was, you know, that was humbling. That was definitely humbling. It was remarkable to watch the way these kids treated the crew, honestly. Wow, these are the people that are going to make you look good on camera, on screen or not. So you might want to readjust. But I do love working on television. So I don't know. Those are some anecdotes, I guess, or feelings. I don't know. Let's see. What's next? If you feel like talking about your mom, how old were you when you learned she was sick? And how did you or she try to prepare you for her transitioning? Oh, wow. You know, I was 11 when my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and it was in September of 1991, and I had just won the Tony Award, which I know some of you hate when I mention, but it is a thing that happened to me, so it's hard to not talk about it sometimes. And also, like, if any of you have won awards, like, please talk about it all the time. It's great. Congratulations. It's a wonderful thing, and you should be proud. Anyway, I just won. And I had just come off of this like big media blitz, you know, where I was doing all these interviews for all these different outlets, and I was like a celebrity, at least in New York, you know? This was way before social media, so obviously, like, fame was a little more contained, especially theater, because it was only in New York, you know, this particular show. And it took me many, many, many years, like into my late 20s, to see how quickly that happened, like June to September. You know, when you're young, time is more expansive. And so 3 months can feel like a really long time. But like, you know, obviously it was the blink of an eye. I see my childhood in like in sections. There's like before I started working, and I started working when I was 9. And those years were difficult. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. We had a house in Brooklyn, but we didn't have money. And the house was dark and scary and had holes in it. And we had holes in our furniture. We had a chair that had no seat. I don't know why we had that, but, you know, we were well fed. Like, food was my mom's most precious thing. But, you know, I don't know that my parents had the happiest marriage. And there was a lot of strife and turmoil in those first 9 years. You know, and then I started working, and those were sort of incredible glory days. I had also been teased a lot as a kid, like in grade school. And so I went from sort of being a pariah to being literally the toast of the town. And that was a really weird mind trip, especially at that age where you're sort of learning who you are and like developing a sense of self. And also learning that you're not the center of the universe. Like, that's in child development. Like, that's around the time that you're learning that. And unfortunately, I sort of was the center of the universe as far as my industry was concerned, right? And so that wreaked havoc. It wreaked havoc in my psyche for a long time. And then the next section is my mom getting sick and then dying. And so it was a very brief period of like being on top, but it was like the tippy top, you know? And then I went arguably about as low as a kid can get in terms of trauma. And when she told me and my sister, I asked, are you going to die? And she said, they don't think so. But it turned out, and this was also something I didn't learn until my late 20s, she was already, I think, stage 3 or 4. And it had already metastasized. They just didn't tell me that because I was working on Broadway and I had too much, like, I don't know what it would have done. It was hard enough to keep going, you know, while she was in treatment. I would go to school at regular school time. We lived in Brooklyn. I went to school in Manhattan. After school, I would go right up to the hospital and spend time with her and do homework there. And then I'd go to the show. And I was in a show about a girl whose parents died, which I think actually, ironically, was sort of what helped me keep going and sort of what got me through it. I often wonder what would have happened to me if I hadn't been in theater. I think in some ways it saved me from a bad fate, you know? I had a responsibility to a lot of people, so I had to keep my shit together. But I wasn't prepared for her to die. Even up to the day that she died about a year and a half after she was diagnosed, I felt blindsided. I was not prepared. She had been staying at home in a hospital bed. And then one night, like very first thing in the morning, the sun had just come up, an ambulance arrived and they took her to the hospice. I didn't understand that that was end of life care or whatever. Although I had cut school the day before. I was cutting school quite a lot back then when my dad found out and took me to task. And I said, if mom dies while I'm in school, I'll never forgive you. But I think I was just being dramatic. I think I was just like using my mom's sickness to sort of deflect, you know, from having cut school. And maybe also to remind him, like, shit's real bad right now. Like, me cutting school, I don't know. It's not like I was doing drugs. Well, I was smoking pot. But anyway, so I'm not sure when I realized she was going to die. I guess maybe when I got to the hospice and I saw what condition she was in, I did not expect to cry. So I apologize. You know, it happened so long ago and it's become such a you know, it's my story. It's the fabric of who I am. But I think that I spent many years so angry about it that I then rounded a corner where I was like, I'm not going to really belabor this point anymore. I think in some ways I've skipped some steps, but I also think that grief is something that doesn't end, you know? It just gets easier and it gets easier over time. But I was 13 and we got to the hospice and she was in very bad shape. We were all there. I mean, we have a very, very small family. So it was just me and my dad and my sister and my mom's very close cousin. I think that's it. Oh, and her friend Janet and Lori. Anyway, there were a few people there. And a priest kept coming and asking if we wanted him to read her her last rites. And she wasn't, I mean, she was Jewish by like descent, but she was not religious at all and was very sort of vehemently anti-organized religion. And so we kept saying no. And then I don't know why, but finally we said yes. And so he came in and I'm so sorry. I didn't mean for this to be like macabre or sad. Anyway, he came in and he read her the psalm, whatever it is, Yea, Though I Walk. And at some point, I left to go call a friend. And I was halfway down the hall and the nurse came running and said that I had to come back. So I went running back and she died. And for many years, I thought it was my fault. I thought if I hadn't left the room, she wouldn't have died. And again, it took me many, many years to change that narrative and many years of reading about, you know, death. I think she didn't want to die in front of me. So I think she was holding on. And I think when I walked out of the room, it gave her permission to let go, which she needed to do because she was in a lot of pain. I'm so sorry. I feel silly. I don't cry that often because I'm on a lot of antidepressants. So this is probably good for me. So I was not prepared to answer your question. A few days before she died, she had this little burst of energy, which is normal. And I sat with her on her hospital bed in her room, in her bedroom. And she just read The New Yorker, which was another favorite thing for her to do. Cooking and The New Yorker and talking on the phone and arguing with people about, you know, politics. And again, it wasn't until some years later that I was like, wow, she used her last bit of energy to read The New Yorker instead of like giving me some Hollywood speech about like, you're going to be okay and I'm so sorry I have to go. You know, I want you to have a happy life. But she was not an emotional person. And she was probably terrified and didn't know what to say. What do you say, you know? About, I don't know, 4 years later or something, that movie Stepmom or Stepmother or whatever the fuck it was called with Julia Roberts and Susan Sarandon came out. And Susan Sarandon's character gets cancer and she basically spends the whole movie preparing her kids for it. And I was so mad that I walked out of the theater. Her next question is, did you stop acting for some years after she passed? No, I did not. I should have, but I did not. I continued to work until I was about 27. Or so. And then I took a break because I was really just sort of frustrated by the industry. I was living in LA. You know, I'd done some guest star roles, but I wasn't getting anywhere. I was constantly being told that I was fat and ugly, you know, by like people who shouldn't have been saying those things to me, managers and agents and random strangers emailing me to tell me that I was too fat to be an actor. And I was just so tired of it, and I didn't want to participate anymore. And then I started performing again just for fun, for friends, like singing at cabarets or open mic nights or whatever. And I remembered how much I loved it and how good I was at making people laugh. So I got back in. You know, again, I feel like in some ways I was very, very lucky to have a career that kept me somewhat on the straight and narrow, although not quite enough, and to have as an outlet, you know, and also just to have other weirdos in my life. I'm not sure I would have survived otherwise, you know? But I was also very lucky to be around before social media, because I don't think I would have survived that either. And I don't mean that metaphorically. I mean that I am such a roly-poly bug that I wouldn't have been able to stand up to the constant scrutiny that comes with social media. I don't know if you've noticed recently. I mean, I just a little while ago was telling you that I'm defensive because of negative comments, but I don't know if you've noticed recently your favorite content creators are all getting pretty defensive and all saying, you know, like, stop asking me about my children, or stop telling me to stop being political, or saying things like, you know, stating an opinion and then sort of going around and around the drain in terms of like, I'm not saying this and I'm not saying that. And please understand that I don't think this and I don't think that. That's because we're all getting bombarded with shitty comments from people on what went wrong. You know, she talked about Mel Gibson and really just quoted him. And people wrote in vitriolically about how cruel she was to him. You know, when you get DMs about a cat food commercial that you made, it just makes it a little harder each time to just make the content, you know, because you're constantly worried about how people are going to react to it. And also, somebody just pointed out to me yesterday that I was trained from a very young age to be in the public eye, and how abnormal that is, and how much it has probably shaped my personality. Which is true. So I'll be writing a book at some point when I have 5 minutes to spare. I'm going to do something actually now as a little bit of a palate cleanser. This is something that I do at the end of each episode of Dear Daisy. Well, now I'm pulling from a different deck because I actually went through this entire deck on Dear Daisy, but I'm going to pull from the Goddess Oracle deck. I know, it's really woo-woo. I used to be like, ugh, tarot cards, but I'm actually, because of Strange and Unexplained, gotten into it. So let's just do a little palate cleanser, and I'll pull a goddess card and we can read about her. Okay? Oh, okay. Well, I got Demeter. She is the goddess of feelings and emotions. That seems apt. I will just, as a disclaimer, say that I've got four cards pulled from the deck permanently, because there, two of them are on my desk. Bridget, the goddess of inspiration, and Lilith, the goddess of power. They're both on my desk. And then I have two on my altar. I have Ikchil for creativity and Lakshmi for abundance. And I also have a Lakshmi statue that one of my listeners sent me, which was so kind. All right, Demeter. Feelings and emotions. I felt it all, the rage, the anger, the joy, the happiness, the tearing, the anguish. And I searched for the middle ground, the shore path between what I felt and what I did with it. Then I shed the skins, the layers that built up when feelings aren't voiced, aren't heard, aren't acknowledged. By giving my feelings their rightful place, I keep myself far from the intensity, immensity, sheer density, and cost of emotion. That felt fitting. All right, thank you. I know this is really different from what we normally do on the show, but I don't know. I thought it might be nice. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you didn't, it's free to not let me know that. It's absolutely free. It doesn't cost you anything. So thank you so much for joining me on this Ask Me Anything, and stay strange. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, Mount Shasta is known for its beauty and majesty. It is a place older than time, and so, of course, it is packed with ghost stories, monsters, and of course, aliens. This episode was engineered and mixed by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.